In 1965, a novel would be released that would change science fiction forever. A piece of mythic storytelling about a hero. A hero that would become the leader of the entire universe. An emperor of the known universe. This was a science fiction novel like none other that had multiple amazing storylines weaving intricate plots about the future of humanity. This was about the planet Arrakis, otherwise known as Dune. Here on the Spicing Guild, a special three-part podcast, part of the Couch Potato Theater series of shows, we'll be looking at David Lynch's 1984 adaptation of the Frank Herbert novel. We'll also be looking at the 2000 miniseries by Sci-Fi Channel, and also the 2003 Children of Dune miniseries. Throughout the podcast, we'll also be covering parts of the novels and, of course, the universe of Dune. Hosted by Adam O'Brien, the Fantha from Down Under from the Fantha from Down Under podcast, and, of course, Fantha Tracks Radio, and co-founding member of Fantha Podcast Network, Kyle Wagner, all here chatting Dune. The podcast must flow. All right, folks, you know the deal. This is Couch Potato Theatre here on Fandom Podcast Network, here in this amazing channel. That's right, created by Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel and, of course, Kyle Wagner. This is amazing channel looking at all things that you love in Fandom. And, of course, this is a Dune special, The Spicing Guild. What we're going to be looking at is the three adaptations so far done of the Dune franchise. Of course, the first one being David Lynch's Dune. So if you're tuning in today, we're going to be looking at David Lynch's film. We're going to be looking at what worked, what didn't. Why was it so polarizing? Why didn't it reach its mass? That's right. This could have been a huge film. This is touted to be the new Star Wars after Return of the Jedi had punched out its last little minutia in the theaters itself. And of course, we have the amazing 2000 edition, which was the miniseries by Sci-Fi Channel, which was much more true to the book, although didn't have the budget to really push it where it needed to. Starring William Hurt and, of course, Susan Sarandon in the 2003 Children of Dune, which was fantastic. And I think, personally, the most true form to both Dune Messiah and Children of Dune when it comes to how good it was. It was fantastic. So we're looking at those on three separate specials here on the Fandom Podcast Network. Hope you enjoy these shows. They've been a real joy to put together. Let's get into it.
Welcome to Couch Potato Theater on Fandom Podcast Network. Your look at the films forgotten that you want to stay at home, sitting on the couch, watching, reminiscing, and loving the trivia. This is the Fandom Podcast Network's look at Dune, The Spicing Guild, a Dune retrospective, and this is part one, looking at David Lynch's Dune. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, the Australian correspondent of Fantha Tracks, and I'm joined by the co-founding member of the podcast channel, Kyle Wagner, host of several shows of the network. How are you, Kyle?
The worm is the spice. I am doing good. I just had to get that out of my system, get it early on. And, you know, this is going to be interesting because Dune is an interesting topic for me because it's been a very long time since I've read the books. I'm talking probably over 20 years ago. I read the books in high school. I've watched a movie here recently as getting ready for this. But, you know, the thing was, is really the movie, when the movie came out, I really didn't go see it in theater. I didn't see Dune for the first time until home video. And I've always considered Dune one of those franchises, especially when you look at this original Dune film, as a movie that had so much potential and created a very interesting visual, but this, it just felt like it never fully connected the way it should have.
100%. And it's been many attempts even before the 1984 David Lynch Dune adaptation. We had Ridley Scott and obviously Yoda Roski doing his own version of things as well, which never got off the ground. And we're going to be talking about some of those today as they were honorable attempts as well, along with Frank Herbert getting scripts ready and really pushing those out there. Dino De Laurentiis, obviously, at the helm of two of those. We'll be talking about those today, but we're also going to be looking at Dune itself, the novel. So if you're in for something when it comes to the world of Frank Herbert's Dune, this is the place to check it out. With Kyle, we're going to be chatting about the adaptations. With today's one, part one looks at 1984's David Lynch film. We're going to be looking at all the cast, the plot, how it all came together, what worked, what didn't work. We'll look at all those sort of angles. And later in the show, and based on the paradigm of the novel, we're going to be looking at the actual novel itself in the three parts that are inside the book. That is, of course, Dune, Muad'Dib and the Prophet with Din of F-105, formerly of the Souls, who is a bit of a, let's just say, a knowledge on the subject as well in as far as the book. So I'm really excited. So I don't know about you, Kyle, but it's going to really delve into the universe.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're not going to get somebody who's more enthusiastic about anything Dune than Din. So he's going to bring some great information on the books later on in the podcast. So, but you know what, Adam, before we get started, would you like me to take care of a little business that we need to do here?
Yeah, let the folks know how they can get in touch with Phantom Podcast Network.
Well, you know, if you're looking for some spice or the Spice Girl, we might be able to give you a connection. I don't know, but I can tell you we can hook you up with some podcasts for sure. And of course, it all starts on the Phantom Podcast Network's homepage at fpnet.podbean.com, where you will find our master feed of all of our great shows. And of course, if you're using your mobile devices, whether you got a phone, a pad, laptop, whatever, you can always use the Podbean app to search Phantom Podcast Network. Of course, we're also on iTunes, Stitcher, and for you Android users, well, you can find us on the Google Play app. Again, just search for the Phantom Podcast Network. Visit our Facebook page, Phantom Podcast Network. We've got all kinds of news. We keep things going on to try to keep you updated on what's happening in the world of Phantom there. Of course, if you like what we're doing or you don't like what we're doing, drop us an email at phantompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Let us know what you think. Give us some ideas. We always like to hear from our listeners. Of course, you can follow us at Instagram at Phantom Podcast Network and on Twitter at FanPod Network. And of course, I'm Kyle. You can find me on Twitter at AKyleW or on Instagram at AKyleFandom. Adam, where can people find you on social media these days?
You can catch me at Obi Pop Culture on both Twitter and Instagram, covering all the shows that I do, whether it's with Phantom Podcast Network, with the amazing Look at Mad Max, Maximum Couch Potato, with, of course, the co-founding members of this amazing channel, Kevin the Raider Nerd, Reitzel, and Kyle Wagner.
You can also catch some hearing there.
That's right, ringside seats at this wrestling event today, I tell you. There you go. And you can also catch me on fanthatracks.com as I am the Fantha from Down Under. That's right, and I cover everything Star Wars with an Australian tinge and a mullet on Fantha Tracks Radio. The Fantha from Down Under.
It is an impressive mullet, I will say. Let's talk. You know, I've been looking at pictures of the Mojave Desert. I've been looking at pictures of the Sahara, just to get myself in the right mindscape for Arrakis. So, I think I'm ready. I don't think I'm ever ready for worms, but hey, you know, we've got Adam, what I think is one of the more interesting and truly not ever fully untapped sci-fi universes in fandom history with Dune.
Oh, without a doubt. You're looking at some of that, like, you think about it. It is a heroic landscape. Whenever you see something like that, it goes right back to the likes of Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, we've got David Lean's great film, which no doubt probably influenced some of what Frank was looking at. Even though when Frank Herbert wrote Dune, he was looking at writing an article for a newspaper about the actual sand dunes themselves and how they've been weathered away and the environment. So it came from a different place, but we're talking about somebody that was interested in leadership, corruption of leadership, and how sometimes heroism itself and leadership, going into power can corrupt and make things worse for humanity.
Yeah, no, and it's such an interesting world in the aspect of how things are given in the world of Dune. You know, how, like in the beginning of the book, House Atreides is taking over the planet from House Harkonnen, and it's basically to try to keep a balance of power within that universe. But it just goes to show you, when you look at what happens in Dune, there's no way. People always crave power, and you know, they don't want to give it up once they have it. And like I said, those who control the spice
control the universe. That's right. Fear is the mind killer. And at the end of the day, I think the universe itself is built around things that are very close to home. This is a human universe. There's no aliens in Dune. You know, it's a reflection on not only the 1960s when Dune was written, but I think very close to where we are as a people and the daily grind that we go through. So it's a very, even though it's a space opera and it's a heroic fantasy, I think at the end of the day, we're heading into something that's very much very true of ourselves, a mirror looking at ourselves.
Dune is a 1965 science fiction novel written by Frank Herbert. Set in the distant, far-off future, two great houses, the House Atreides and the House Harkonnen, are locked in a bitter battle, a feud that's been going on for almost a millennia. The Duke Atreides, his name is Duke Leto Atreides, has been outswayed by his enemy, the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, into taking on what seems to be a great job, the job of looking after the fiefdom of Arrakis, a planet that is completely covered by deserts. A desert planet where there's only one prized possession, water. But it also has one amazing wealth to it, and that is, of course, the spice melange. It is a drug and one that is prized completely throughout the entire empire. Duke Leto Atreides and his wife, the Lady Jessica, and son Paul are now known throughout, and also expect nothing but a trap when they get to Arrakis. But when they find the shock and circumstance of what happens on Arrakis, it leads to not only a hero's journey like no other, it also unlocks some of the most biggest secrets of this universe. For Paul Atreides, this will be his rise to becoming not only a revolutionary leader, but the emperor of the known universe.
When Frank Herbert wrote this, I mean, and there have been Dune stories going for years, and the worlds have been built so huge. But he opened a Pandora's box almost, I think. Dune is what I always have called thinking man's fandom. And the aspect of Dune has always been more about making you think, and really more what I call advanced science fiction. It's really kind of a level above than a lot of other fictions. It's kind of, and that's always the way Frank Herbert has been, is that his writing style is, you know, I'm going to say this, and I don't know one other way to compare it. It's kind of what reminds me of, like, if you ever tried to read L. Ron Hubbard in Dianetics or something, like, you read it and it gives you a headache at first because it's just, there's the concepts are so above your head. And I think with his books, and especially with Dune, either you adjust to it or you walk away from it. There's no real middle ground there. If you can't feel yourself getting absorbed into it early on, you're going to walk away from it. And I think you look at how fans of Dune are, and I think that's very obvious. And it's one of the reasons why I think we have yet to have a truly big box office Dune movie or series, because it's a very hard thing to wrap your mind around and get right. I mean, what I think it's worth talking about is how hard it was just to get to this 1984 adaptation done.
Mm. Oh, without a doubt. You've got to look at, you know, it was first picked up by Arthur P. Jacobs, who had done such a good job with Planet of the Apes. Now, even if you go far back as Planet of the Apes, they had a specific vision for that as well through the books, which was high-tech society of apes. They weren't actually able to put that together because at the end of the day, they just didn't have the budget to be able to do. And it's the same with Dune. You know, how do you tell this multi-layered, as you say, it's a huge universe which is over your head when it comes to the concepts which what Frank put in the book. So it takes a few reads sometimes to really see what he was doing with Mentats, with the spacing deal, with the navigators, with the Bene Gesserit, which, again, are a huge influence on characters or even societies like the Jedi in Star Wars. A lot of these huge things about furthering the mind of humanity. How do you get that down onto the page? So obviously Arthur P. Jacobs tried. Then we had Jodorowsky, who, of course, had an idea for a 10-hour film. I mean, you know, how do you get the likes of that David Carradine playing Leto, his own son playing Paul Atreides, and Mick Jagger playing the role that eventually went to Sting in the 1984 adaptation? So, I mean, there was some really huge things. You had Giga involved in making the Harkonnen castles and stuff like that. You had rock bands playing the music for each of the different planets you were going to see in this universe. So it was going to be huge. It really would have been, I think, more akin to The War of the Worlds by Jeff Wayne.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, and we look at it, Dune is such a huge project and such a huge book to adapt. I mean, even the David Lynch version initially was, after the initial cut, was 4 hours long. And I mean, we look at now the fact that we have a new version of Dune that is coming in a couple of years with Denis Villeneuve, who I think is perfect director to handle something like this. But he's already said it will be broken down into two films. And I think that is one of the problems with Dune 1984 is it's just too much story to try to put into one film. I really think in the case of Dune would have been better off if somebody could really have brought an adaptation to the studios that said, this has to be a trilogy.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think, look, at some points, even Lynch was like, well, this is too big for one film. You know, how do we extrapolate this and make it to a point where it's going to fit the paradigm of maybe a trilogy, which I think they did better with the 2000 miniseries, which we'll talk about, obviously, in the next episode. But you got to think about it. It was originally also going to be directed by Ridley Scott for Dino De Laurentiis before he did Blade Runner. Now, some unfortunate events with his eldest brother passing away steered him away from the Dune project, which I think he was still another 12 months of concept work before he was going to shoot something. But he says in the Blade Runner behind the scenes, Dangerous Stacy says he was leaning heavily, very heavily towards a Star Wars aesthetic. Even though it would have been a lot darker. And what I can tease is a little bit of research I've done on this. He was basing some of the ways he's going to film this off the Battle of Algiers, the actual film. So, which would have been a bit more guerrilla sort of style, I suppose, when it comes down to it. But you can just imagine what Ridley would have done. I think you would have got a cerebral Star Wars.
I agree. I don't... You know, I think that's the thing with Dune, though, is you've got to take Dune and make it its own thing. You can't. I mean, you're always going to have comparisons to movies, but I don't even know if Dune doesn't feel like it's right for that kind of faster-paced Star Wars feel to it. If anything, as far as pacing-wise, it might be a little bit better actually taking a Star Trek-type pace.
I agree.
And it's just because Dune is not necessarily an action film. Dune is a very cerebral science fiction film. And again, that's why I say with this current remake that they're doing, they've got the perfect director for it because he does cerebral science fiction so well. And, you know, when you look back at this 1984 version of Dune directed by David Lynch, I almost think that's one of the problems with this film is that David Lynch kind of has a similar issue that Frank Herbert has. He gets too cerebral. He gets too concerned. David Lynch, in a lot of his films, gets a little out there. I know a lot of people like it, you know, obviously Twin Peaks, things like that, but I think one of the problems that I've always had with the 1984 Dune is I think it almost focuses a little bit too much on this inner monologue of Paul Atreides.
Mm. Yeah, I think, and especially in the version of that we see, the theatrical cut. So we're not talking about the television cut that went out, which is, I think, a 3-hour adaptation, if I remember right. That was
the director's cut that they eventually put out several years later.
I think that's the first version of Lynch's Dune I saw, which is technically called the Alan Smithy cut. So the one he said, "Hey man, I didn't do that, man." You know, he basically, you know, he took his name away from the project.
Yeah, I remember when that happened. Yeah, he was very upset that they put this out.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if it played the same in the States. When it came out here, it was on local television. It was split into 2 days. So maybe like the Denis Villeneuve film will be. So this was split where at the end peak where the Harkonnen come into Arrakeen and actually take over the palace, Leto dies and basically Paul Atreides and Jessica led out into the desert to die. So that's the cliffhanger that was left on. I have a feeling we're going to get that with this Denis Villeneuve film, but that was my first indication of it. And we had that really, to be honest, pretty ordinary prologue to the film where we have the book opening and you have some old guy talking about it with a painting in the background going, "This is Giedi Prime, this is Arrakis, this is Carino, you know, the houses of Carino, Atreides and Harkonnen, and this is the universe of Dune," basically talking about the slavery leading to obviously rebellion, the Butlerian Jihad, and leading to where we are now. But I always thought it was better. Virginia Madsen did a great job of it in the film. She just told you straight away, because at the start of each book, you've got Irulan, Princess Irulan.
You know, and I think that's one of the frustrating things for me about that 84 movie Dune is I've always been a huge Virginia Madsen fan, and it just felt like, you know, okay, here you've got Virginia Madsen right in the, you see her in the beginning, you see her towards the end, but otherwise completely forgot about, and what a waste of such a talented actress.
That's right. I mean, we really don't get to see in as far as adaptations what Irulan's all about until the 2000 miniseries. But speaking of, let's have a look at a few of the characters. Now, this is a movie in particular that has a massive amount of characters. Different houses. We've got the Fremen, we have the smugglers, of course we have houses Carino, etc. So let's start from the top. One of the most famous obviously being Francesca Rannis from Kroll as Lady Jessica.
Yeah, and I had forgotten that she was in Kroll. It had been a while and I put those together. I mean, she was actually one of the highlights of the film for me. Jessica was amazing in this film. And I think it was one of the better adaptations of this film, characters of this film, because David Lynch definitely took a little bit of leeway with a lot of the characters in this film.
Oh yeah, big time. I think even some of the characters are sort of stripped of some of their specialty or some of their traits in some regards. I mean, it's a very linear adaptation in some ways. So when you come to Jessica, she's probably one of the better ones when it comes to what she's given to do on screen. She's got a lot of screen time. And I think she's brilliant in this, you know. And then we have Brad Dourif as Peter DeVries.
Yeah, but come on, Brad Dourif, he's amazing in whatever he does.
He is. He's brilliant. I mean, I was watching the first season of X-Files the other day, and he popped up for an episode there. I mean, he just takes over. He's a character actor that really holds the people's attention straight away. Like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, when you see him in that, and when he's the young kid that's stuck in the asylum, but that's done so well.
Yeah. You know, one of the things too, we talk about Virginia Madsen. I think it's one of the things that's always kind of stood out to this movie is that I know a lot of people went and saw Dune after Star Trek The Next Generation hit so big because Patrick Stewart was in this film.
That's right. Now, of course, we're talking about Jean-Luc Picard, Engage. That's right. Now, we're talking about a guy who obviously was a Shakespearean actor in London and a fantastic talent who really didn't know too much about, I think, at the time, about film and stuff like that and television. He was more a stage presence, a stage actor. But he'd done John Borman's Excalibur and a couple other films, and then this came along, and I think he just jumped at the chance to do something international. But, I mean, he really takes the role of Gurney Halleck very seriously. You know, he's the master at arms. He really is a powerful presence, isn't he?
Yeah, without a doubt. One of the other characters who I always felt was portrayed very well in this was Kenneth Gunn as Baron.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, they put a fat suit on him.
Yeah.
So he could, but the outlandish behavior, you know. And I, the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, encompasses his doom. You know, he gets right out there. The performance is fantastic. If anything, it's a stage performance. But, you know, the way Lynch has sort of built that character around that, I think he's hanging around on a hook pretty much, on basically a wire most of the time because of the floating harnesses. It works so well. Then we have the likes of Freddie Jones, again, from, guess what, Krull.
Yep.
Pretty sure. Yep,
a lot of connections between those two films.
That's right. And only made, I'm pretty sure they were made within a year of each other.
Yeah.
This was like 85 or something.
Krull was 83, I thought. Like 83.
Oh, what? May have come before. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So they've worked on that. And of course, Freddie's been in almost every movie ever made when it comes to British film. And it's Tufa Hawa in the Mentat. He plays it very well. I think they actually did Mentats better in this one than they did the other adaptations so far. And of course, that goes also with Pieter de Vries, with the Sappho juice, the stain, yeah, and the lip, stuff like that. Interestingly enough, Pieter de Vries is named in the Dune novel as Pieter de Vried, with a D on the end, not an S. And I think it's been changed since in other work, since the Lynch film, to de Vries. So it's canon now as de Vries, which is interesting. Richard Jordan as Duncan Idaho.
Yeah, you know, what's so funny for me with this is, again, this goes back to with Dune. These characters are so unique. And a lot of people, you know, with Star Wars, the general public, you can say Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and they know who we're talking about. But with Dune, outside of maybe Paul Atreides, people just don't know these characters unless they're a fan of Dune. And, you know, as we're going through these characters, I think that's one of the things. It's just like, Dune just... Oh, it's frustrating because you can see where Dune could be so big, and yet it's just like there's this... It's this cult, it's in this cult status, and it can't seem to break out of it.
That's right. And I think part of it's to do with that, you know, you don't have the humor that you have in Star Wars for the mainstream audience when it comes to adaptations really to take hold of. I mean, the people that you'd really use for that would be Gurney Halleck.
Yes.
I mean, it would be implied humor. You know, a lot of his lines are pretty funny when you think about it. So it's a way you sort of bring that around. Which, of course, brings us to Everett McGill as Stilgar. And of course, Everett McGill, the bad guy from Under Siege 2. That's right. He's also in Twin Peaks. I've always liked Everett. I think he's a great actor. And he's also in Heartbreak Ridge.
Yeah, and I thought he was great as Stilgar in this. You know, it's funny, too, how many of these people have kind of stayed connected with David Lynch over the years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they've been in multiple films in different areas. You got Jürgen Prochnow now as Duke Leto.
Actually, and I thoroughly enjoyed him as Duke Leto. I thought he was actually very solid in that role. He had the right presence for that character.
Yeah, look, I liked William Hurt's one, but I still think Jürgen Prochnow is tougher, more real world, and he actually looks like the one that's described in the novel. Like, you know, he has the Atreides look.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about William Hurt, when we'll talk about this in the miniseries too, William Hurt always kind of comes across as a little bit more of a kindly father, where here there's a kindness, but he's got that edge. He wants to teach his son how to survive.
That's right. He's a battle hardened leader. You know, you got to think about it before this, and it's in some of the other books, which we'll talk about some of them. We're going to be sticking mainly to Dune itself. You know, he's been through the War of Assassins, things like that. I mean, these are to a point where, to give a bit of background for our listeners, the War of Assassins is pretty much the point where you got to think about the technology. 20,000 years in the future, still the most powerful thing is atomics.
Yeah.
And they've also got the development of body shields. Problem is, the lace gun fires against a shield, it almost has an atomic explosive quality. So, to the point where now people are back using blades, basically, unarmed and bladed combat. just to combat this. So that's why it's called personal man-to-man combat again. So War of Assassins is pretty much that, to not have the big body count that you would have, or the, you know, the likelihood of others getting killed instead of the intended targets. So they've been through that, so they're battle-hardened, and I think the performance really brings it. Paul Smith as the Beast Raban, and I think Paul Smith I knew mainly from Robocop 2.
Yep. He was very interesting in this. House Harkonnen was portrayed so bizarre. Across the board, so bizarre. And it kind of leads into the next casting of Sting, because...
Oh, yeah.
You know, I love Sting. He's an amazing performer. But outside of a couple of things with Guy Ritchie, Sting really should have never tried acting.
Oh, definitely. Look, what I like is he plays it quite nasty in this, and he's only got a little bit of screen time here and there, you know? I think the best scene is at the end when they have literally the man-to-man fight with Paul Atreides, and he's taunting him, you know? I will kill him! Yeah. I will kill him! You know, and it's just annoying enough. You know, you can kind of feel that what Kyle MacLachlan's character is going through, which we haven't talked about yet. Kyle MacLachlan.
Yeah, well, let's hold off on that, because there's a couple other things I want to hit, because I think we've got to really give Kyle MacLachlan his due here, but there's a couple other things I want to hit as far as the cast goes. I want to hit Dean Stockwell, because if any character got a raw deal in Dune, it was his character.
Oh, yeah, definitely. The tooth. And he had the world's best mustache in this one, didn't he?
And then there was the cat.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Look, I think when you look at the character itself, here's the guy who's torn between two worlds, where his wife has been kidnapped, probably dead by the Harkonnens, and he's got the chance that maybe he'll see her again. So he plays it quite well. You can kind of see that he's trying to hide his aggression, the fact that he's setting up this revenge against the Harkonnen. But at the same time, if you look at the performance, you can tell he's having trouble with it because he loves these people that he's about to betray.
Yeah. Of course, you have Max von Sydow in this. What classic sci-fi thing hasn't he been a part of?
Oh, yeah. I kind of feel like this is the same character. Liet Kynes rocks up in Force Awakens, and it's the same character. Look, it's, you know, a battle-hardened, well, in this case, a world-traveled traveler. You know, he's somebody that's been around the place. Obviously, he's a dual part where he's both working for the Empire itself as the Imperial Ecologist, but he's also the Fremen leader. Mm.
Then I want to address to me, at least in this particular, in the 84 film, the character that stood out the most for me, and that is Aaliyah Atreides, but more because of the amazing performance by Alicia Ronan Witt, who just, you hear that voice coming out of that little girl.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It really sells the idea that she's been open to the what they call the outer world, or the other voices through the Bene Gesserit lineage. So she knows all those Reverend Mother's voices and their history, and she brings that to bear. So she's basically an adult in a kid's body.
Yeah, but just portrayed so well. And come on, my brother's coming for you. Yeah.
And that slowed down bit where she's got the knife out, and, you know, she's savoring the revenge, and they play that great music behind it. It is such an amazing moment. But we also have the director himself, David Lynch, in the spice hauler when they try and get in there and obviously trying it out. And he has that great dialogue with Jürgen Prochnow.
Yeah. But I think that leaves the two main actors for this film, and I think they both have their share of controversy when it comes to this film. And before we get to our main lead, Kyle MacLachlan, we got to talk about Sean Young in this film, because...
Oh, yes, Sean Young. And if anyone hasn't been on YouTube yet and checked it out, Sean Young has actually done some great behind-the-scenes filming from when they were working in Mexico on the film itself at Churubusco Studios.
Yeah. But it was shortly after this film that Sean Young pretty much lost her mind.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we're talking about the same lady who obviously missed out an opportunity to play Vicki Vale in 1989's Batman, but felt that, well, if I missed out on one, I need to be in for Batman Returns. And turned up in a cat outfit to stalk the one, the only Tim Burton, and apparently got kicked out of the office straight away.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people are not a fan of her performance in this film.
Very dry,
you know. And I think that's, to me, always been the same thing with Shanya. She doesn't have range. She's just the same thing in every film she ever does.
She worked well as a robot and, oh, well, as an android in, of course, Blade Runner. But I think that goes with the experience of, you know, not pushing the acting where it should. I think, you know, it was played much better in later adaptations, obviously, with Barracadabra in which we're going to talk about in the next one. So, which brings us, of course, to Kyle MacLachlan, who was a Dune fan. So he'd been a big fan of the original trilogy of books and knew the character extremely well going in.
Yeah, you know, I know this was kind of a mixed casting at this point, too. A lot of people were like, really? Kyle MacLachlan as Paul Atreides?
Right.
And, you know, I think he actually put in a pretty good performance here, but he was a victim of what I call David Lynching. It became too focused on the inner monologue of Paul Atreides. And a lot of people I talked to, it wasn't until they're going back and giving Dune another rewatch, really understood everything that was going on with Paul Atreides in this film.
Oh, exactly. I mean, and you got to think about it. It's somebody who is, again, coming from the stage as well, being a stage actor. His first time in front of camera, particularly for a live action feature. So, very interested that they chose that way to go about it. So Dune itself was actually optioned as far back as 1971 with Arthur P. Jacobs. So that's how long in gestation this was. That's a long time, isn't it?
I kind of look at Dune as one of those eternal Hollywood projects.
Oh, yeah. And,
you know, we've had this film, we've had the miniseries, which I am a big fan of both Dune and Children of Dune that the Sci-Fi Channel did back in the early 90s, and I think those were actually early 90s, early 2000s. I guess it was more close to the early 2000s, but you know, we've never had that true just all-in adaptation of Dune, and I hope maybe now we're finally going to get it. But I remember when the 84 film came out and there was a lot of hype for it. It was getting a lot of publicity. There was some big marketing campaigns. And I remember everybody came coming out of it going, what did I just see? People were very confused by this film. And I think it's in part because of the way David Lynch makes films. And I think in part of it is too, they had to cut so much out. They had to cut so much out. And I think it took away from the heart of the Dune story, Adam. And I mean, I know how much big fan you are of these books, and I mean, I've talked to Dune fans who are much bigger fans of Dune than I am, and they all say the same thing, that the 84 movie, it was a visually beautiful film, but it wasn't Dune. It had the baseline of Dune, but that was about it.
Oh, exactly. And even Frank Herbert himself wrote some thoughts on the film itself, because again, he was on the set quite a bit, and therefore basically anyone to come up and ask about the universe of Dune. Of course, we have his thoughts on it, you know, and they ask why just a 2-hour film. And basically the length can be shown more frequently on a day-to-day versus return to the investment quickly. So that's a quote from Frank Herbert's Eye. So it's a little book that you can actually pick up, which has a number of different short stories by him, but also a feature of illustrations called The Road to Dune. So definitely go and check that out if you can find a copy. But the actual universe itself, you think about it, that's all about basically ticket sales. That's all that's about. So again, maybe, you know, going into it, films of that time weren't long. You know, the 80s, we had the time of Stallone, Schwarzenegger, Van Damme. Your longest movie was 90 minutes. 90 minutes was a fairly long affair. So I think when they were looking at it, that was only the business of the time. I think they're just a product of, you know, revenue, pretty much.
Yeah, you know, here is the thing with it, too, is I think Dune suffered from Star Wars. I think because people were so, that sci-fi, fast-paced action, when they hit Dune and the Dune slower pace, I kind of think people weren't ready for that in that kind of science fiction yet. I think people were still riding that Star Wars high. So,
oh, yeah, definitely. It's more akin to Lawrence of Arabia than it is anything else. It's T. Lawrence, pretty much, when you think about it. And that's not a fast-paced story. That's a story about a guy who obviously has to leave his, you know, main area, the British Army, and has to become a part of the Arabic communities that are in that area to really survive and to learn from and become a hero of. So I think that's one of the things that people forget. You know, it's quite a long story. You can't just go, righto, let's do it like Hollywood does it now. Because if they did, they would start it when they crash land their Thopter in the middle of the desert, wouldn't they? Because that's right in the heat of the action.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about the universe that the film does build, because it is a stunning visual universe. I think the unique looks of all the houses are amazing. Arrakis itself is absolutely beautiful. One of the things I loved at the time and still love to this day was the armor. The way the armor looked with kind of that fractal look to it. I always thoroughly enjoyed that. Just so many things. That's one thing David Lynch really did, was built this amazing visual world.
He did. I mean, you've got all the different houses. You have the Fremen. You have the Sardaukar, which aren't Harkonnen, but they have to be built into that world. And Bob Ringwood, the designer, had to basically, in his own, to quote him, it's a mixture of fantasy period costumes and fetish industrial costumes. And it kind of really is when you think about it. You know, the still suits themselves were a very, you know, definite departure from what would be the norm. And it was the first of the muscle suits. Now, we didn't have back 1989 outfit, which was designed by the same guys. If you look at the likes of the Harkonnen, for example, there's a real Napoleon sort of look to the outfits there, particularly for the Baron himself. You know, he's got that huge Renaissance-style jacket, which we saw by the Emperor and stuff like that at that period. We also see the Atreides wearing a very much an officer's uniform from the period. So it's a very Renaissance look. I think that's one of the interesting things that they went for in it. But, I mean, go all the way forward to that, you've also got the guerrilla fighters of the desert, the still suits. And that must have been a hard thing for them to come up with, just based on the idea that Frank Herbert had this suit where you could literally gain water from your moisture.
Yeah. And, you know, that was, you know, there were so many innovative ideas, and that was always a big one of them. And it's actually been something that's portrayed in a lot of other things going forward. I know there's been things with spacesuits where, you know, the sweat bodily fluids are recycled in the spacesuit to clear water. But, you know, it's that concept. I think the whole concept of the armor, of the worms, of the spice, they were also interesting and unique concepts that I think a lot of people have taken over the years, especially from the novels themselves, and applied them to other things in film.
Oh, definitely. The Dune universe itself obviously has those bits of technology, and we have the likes of, obviously, too, the weaponry, which was interesting to this. Now, one of the things that Lynch couldn't wrap his hand around, well, it was basically the idea of Kung Fu on the sand dunes, which was pretty much the Weirding Way. So the Bene Gesserit have a martial art, which is one that makes them so quick they can move without being seen. So it was almost like, I suppose, the Matrix in some ways, you know? You're going to see that sort of kung fu on the sand dunes, and David Lynch is like, nah, don't know if I'm going to do that. His idea was to change it to a sound weapon called the Weirding Module. Now, this is the one thing that gets described about at the start of the series, where they obviously have the knife fight with Gurney. And then we say, right, get the Weirding Module. Let's see how this goes. One of the key things here is that he took the idea of sound, which is called the voice in Dune, and turned it into a weapon.
Yeah, and what a great concept at the time. And I love how, that's one of the things I did love, how it was portrayed in the David Lynch film and how they developed that skill, and they did put a good focus on that. And it's very unique, and it's something I really haven't seen done outside of like maybe Banshee of the X-Men using sonics that way. But I mean, it's really something I haven't seen used in a weapon in this way in another film, even to this day.
That's right. And like, a lot of people don't realize, as you get towards the end of the film, he doesn't need the module anymore. So he's basically projecting his voice so powerful. When he finally kills Fate, he calls it out, and then the body cracks open in half on the tiling. So it's all about extending the idea that Frank heard originally. So it's a visual metaphor.
Yeah, and it's a visual metaphor, and I think it's just a great metaphor of people using their own power, people getting their own power by doing that, because not everybody could do it. But, you know, to some people it came absolutely naturally, but it's finding your inner power, and I think that's kind of one of the messages he tried to portray with that.
Oh, definitely. Now, we've got to remember, this has gone through a number of adaptations. Just quickly going to go through, obviously, Alejandro Jodorowsky did a version, which you can go into more of if you like, listeners. Check out Jodorowsky's Dune, which came out in 2013. And it was basically a look at what the film was going to be about. It was also going to be about the casting. And Dan O'Bannon from Alien and from Dark Star actually was going to be one of the main contributing factors to this for the visual effects. Now, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I keep going back to it because it doesn't stand out to me. The visual effects are so just it's what makes this film for me. What makes this film enjoyable for me to see. I mean, the final battle at when they take back Arrakis is just when they're on the worm and just visually stunning. And I think that just the look of the planet of Arrakis is so unique, and so I think it makes it its own character, which, you know, for any kind of movie where you can make a planet the part of the character, it works so well, and it tells me so much about the creative minds behind it, especially on the visual side.
Definitely. Now, good thing about after the actual filming of the actors and the locations, they spent quite a bit of time on these, which of course these are the fantastic ships that you see, whereas the idea of the Atreides Ornithopters, we have these amazing Harkonnen ships, which I think were such a bizarre design, but they look evil. I mean, they really look the part. These were huge models again, miniatures. You could call it miniatures, but it really isn't a miniature, you know, at the end of the day, because they're quite big. You've also got the idea of the Guild Navigator, which we see at the start. Now, that was huge. That was massive, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that was one of the better interesting designs. And there's one thing I really did like about Dune was a lot of the ship designs and the technology designs felt science fiction, but they had an old school science fiction look to them. They didn't look like super space agey. They kind of had a little bit of a retro feel to them, I guess is the best way I can put that.
Yeah, it was kind of like a 1960s or maybe a 1950s, almost a Flash Gordon vibe. But again, with that, I always thought, you know, it has a Shakespearean fantasy feel to the design of the interiors and stuff like that. Almost a Baroque sensibility. And there's something about that, because that was, again, taking that design and pushed further with Dune 2 and with Emperor, Battle for Dune, and games like that later on, where they actually took the design further and put more characters in the universe for us to use for Dune 2000, stuff like that.
Yeah, and it was so interesting when I look at this and I look at the Dune 2000, just how much I think the look and feel changed a lot in that miniseries. And I know we'll talk about that some more, but, you know, one of the things we haven't really talked about yet too is the Fremen and the worm and the whole feel of that. And how do you feel that was portrayed in the film, Adam?
I think it was portrayed better than the miniseries. I think the Dune, you know, look, particularly in this film alone, the worm itself is given a more massive and more muscular appearance. And it's very much what we saw in the 1970s hardcover version. So this sort of enveloping, opening to the actual worm itself and the massive structure. I don't think we get that with the CGI renditions that we saw in 2003. It sort of failed to show its mass, its weight, its height. These are massive animals. These are the whales of this universe. I mean, they're massive. And the fact that when somebody jumps on them to ride them, they should be tiny. I mean, they should really be small. And I do like what they did with that. I thought that was really well done, particularly at the end battle where we see Arrakeen and obviously the Emperor's ship being surrounded by these massive worms. It's like an old ship battle, you know, from the days of the pirates and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I get it. You're right. The thing about the worms that works so well in the 84 version is the fact that they are so massive, and they have this feel to them of like everything feels smaller. But because the Fremen control the worm, you feel like okay, they're unstoppable. They're just and the importance they placed on the worm and the importance that they placed on what it meant, and what it meant was, I think a lot of people didn't really catch on that the first time around and caught on to it later. And of course, you know, one of the things I always loved about Din was obviously the Arrakis effect, the blue eyes.
Oh yeah, the blue within blue.
Yes,
the melange, the spice does it to you. It's the spice eyes, you know, like it's great. You take too much, you get addicted to it, and you get this basically the spice eyes.
Yeah. So, but I want to ask you this too, Adam, with the 1984 cut of Dune. Do you think if it was made today and had never been made in 84, like David Lynch was doing Dune for the first time now, do you think he would have had more freedom to do the film he really truly wanted to do?
If it was now, yes. I think, you know, because again, who he is now. You got to think about, you know, he'd only done, what was it, three films, Eraserhead and Elephant Man, and I think one other movie for June. I mean, the only other film that he was getting geared up for at that time was just in chats with George Lucas to do Return of the Jedi. And there's that famous bit of YouTube footage which you can find where even Lynch says he got a headache from all the information George was giving him. And the headache got bigger when he talked about Wookiees, you know, So basically he said, well, I'm not doing that. And then he was given Dune, which he even says, you know, he's not a sci-fi guy, but, you know, when he read the novel and found, you know, talking to Frank, you got a sense of where things go. But yeah, he wouldn't have had the freedom that a director would have now. Like Danny Villeneuve would say would have a certain amount of freedom.
Yeah, and I don't even think David Lynch would be the director of it at this point in time if the film was being made for the first time today. I know that Virginia Madsen has said too that she had signed a 3-movie contract for Dune.
That's right. They were going to be doing for basically the first 3 books. It was going to be Dune, Dune Messiah, and Children of Dune.
Yeah, and you know, nobody's actually ever finished out the Dune trilogy, because even Sci-Fi only got to Children of Dune as far as the miniseries go. If I'm remembering correctly, so nobody's actually done a full on all 3 of the main foundation books of Dune.
Well, that is the 3.
Yeah, but like I said, nobody's actually finished movies of all of.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. They've only done a miniseries, yeah, of them. There's never been an adaptation of the sequels proper.
And, yeah.
I think could you really do that with Dune the way that he did it anyway? Because he brought rain down on Arrakis at the end of it, which doesn't happen. I mean,
let's just no, that was quite the difference.
Yeah, yeah. And people were tearing their hair out at the end of watching it going, does he get what Frank was on about? I mean, it's a visual metaphor that obviously the environment's going to change. But it doesn't change until much later into Children of Dune, where obviously there's little bits of vegetation starting to pop up on the surface of Arrakis. So it does happen, but it takes many years.
So I guess my question is this. Does this version of Dune help the franchise or hurt the franchise?
I think it hurts it more than it does better. And I think the biggest thing is that it's not Dune. And I think a lot of people will look at it, you know, visually, there's stuff that's so Dune. There's parts of it that are really an extrapolation of, you know, what it means to be Dune. Problem is that there's, you know, the hardcore fans who love what Dune is. I, like myself, I love Dune for what it is in the books. And in some ways, maybe it should stay in this book. Maybe even Denny's film will be too far removed from it. It is a tricky book to adapt. You know, there's plots within plots, wheels within wheels, multi-layered parts. that you can't just put into a film. Film is always going to be linear. It's like taking Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep and giving it Blade Runner. Blade Runner is a very linear story, but visually it's complex. And I think that's what we get with the Dune 1984. Visually, very complex film, like Lynch has put out. But unfortunately, not the story that Frank was telling fully. And I think it's, you know, it's been distilled as much as it can go into a two-hour film.
So let me ask you this, because we've seen TV attempts of Dune. Obviously, they did the, what was it, six-hour miniseries, I believe. Was that original miniseries? It was a three-part miniseries?
Correct.
Does Dune, even though we know we have films, Dune is, to me, one of those kind of books that you really want to see something on the big screen with it, but I also look at it and go, you know what, this screams to be something on Netflix to where they can really develop the story. So is it just me, or does it feel like it's in that kind of catch-22 boat almost, where it would be better probably on a Netflix for telling the story, but to get that true visual feel of Dune, we really need it on the big screen?
These are long stories. I mean, they really are. You know, you look at George R. Martin with HBO. To tell his stories, you can't really do it in a two-hour film. And that's what a film company would make you do. You know, George, bring it down to 2 hours. We need 2 hours. We need to make ticket sales. It's a business. Yes, you've got to make money with it. But, however, a platform like HBO, a platform like Netflix or Amazon, doing Dune would be perfect, particularly the first book. Now, because that's a big book. It's not a small read. And has multiple things going on at once. To do it properly would be like the likes of Game of Thrones. You just have to do it that way. It worries me that we're doing two films out of one book when it really should be three at minimum. It really should be based on the paradigm of the novel. Dune, which is the first part of the book. Muad'Dib, which is the second, and The Prophet, which is the third. So if they're able to bring those together, then we really have something extraordinary. So I would say Denny's going to have to cut a lot of what's in there. You're not going to get as many characters. He'll be distilling it down. Visually, it'll be interesting, but will it be as powerful?
Yeah, and that's a question. I think Denny has a very good chance of pulling off something very, about as close as we're probably ever going to get to an actual Dune true-to-the-book film. So I'm looking forward to see what he's going to do. You know, this has been one of the more interesting Couch Potato Theaters because it's such a bizarre nature of this film and kind of its place in cinematic history.
Oh, definitely. Well, you got to think about it. There's a time where, you know, we had fantasy films ruling the roost just after Star Wars had departed in 83 with Return of the Jedi. You know, we were up for something a bit different, and this was really meant to be the big Star Wars event next, you know, the next sort of massive franchise, and it never took off. It really, I mean, Kroll was probably more a crowd pleaser than this film, and it was geared towards that. So it's interesting that this film never really found its place. Critically torn apart, audiences completely left in regards to, you know, it not being the Dune that they wanted.
Yeah. Now, we do have something interesting that you're going to be doing at the end of each of these shows. Isn't that right, Adam?
We are. So what we've decided to do is, this is designed for people that haven't really read Dune before or may know just the movies. Obviously, we're celebrating here on Couch Potato the theatre, the adaptations of Dune. But at the end of these, we're going to be joined by Din of F-105, a dear friend of mine and dear friend of Kyle's, who is somebody that loves the books, reads them at least once a year. And we're going to look at, for 20 minutes in each episode, one part of Dune. So on this episode, you're going to see the first part, Dune. We're going to talk about what it's about, what we liked about it, and what you can really find to enjoy in those stories. In the second one, when we do the mini-series, we're going to be looking at the second part. And then, of course, when we do Children of Dune episode, we're going to be looking at the third part. So you've got a full hour with Din over three episodes looking at what it means to be Dune.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to hearing that from Din. But before we come back and Adam goes to Din and we give you our final thoughts on Dune, got a little promo we're going to play for you. So just sit back, relax, enjoy your spice, and listen to what's coming else is coming out via the Fandom Podcast Network.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal Podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal Podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
All right, welcome to Couch Potato Theatres, The Spicing Guild. This is part two of our first episode here, where we're going to be chatting to Din, one of my dear friends. And I tell you, he's a huge Dune fan, like myself and Kyle. But we're not going to be talking about the 1984 Lynch film. We're actually going to talk about today the first part of Dune, which, believe it or not, is called Dune. So Din is here with us today, coming all the way from Canada. He's a lead singer and songwriter of the band F-105, formerly also of The Souls. Mate, how are you?
I'm good. How you going? How you going, mate?
Good, mate. How you going?
how you going?
Yeah, we're chatting today about one of, I think, one of our favourite things, which of course is Frank Herbert's amazing story, Dune. I mean, you don't get any better than this story when it comes to science fiction, do you?
Well, I would say that Dune is the Bible of sci-fi meets fantasy. Just as I would say that Lord of the Rings is the Bible of modern fantasy. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, without Dune, there's no Star Wars.
This is true. It's influenced a lot. And I think one of the greatest things is it takes that classic trope of the hero's journey and takes it to a whole new level. Now, we're going to be talking about, for the next 20 minutes here, the first book, which introduces the planet Arrakis, introduces the great houses, House Atreides, House Harkonnen, and House of Carino. What did you love about the start of this novel?
I think I was, if I remember when I first read it, and maybe just shortly after college, I was sucked into the world, but also something that felt very Star Warsian to me, which was this young kid, Paul Medivh, who was being mentored. Like, they go right into his mentor relationships, and he has a few of them. I guess he's being trained in fighting combat by Gurney Halleck, and Gurney's such a great character. He's like that mentor that you want to be also your best friend, you know, someone to go out and have a drink with. So I like that mentorship. I like the mentorship he was getting from his mom in the weirding ways, and how that sort of trinity of characters, him and his mom, and when the Bene Gesserit what's her name again? Who tested him in the Gom Jabbar?
And that is, of course, the Helen Gaius Mohyam.
Yes, right. I'm still, the one thing from my concussion a year ago is I'm mostly healed, but I still forget names. It's weird. I forgot Will Ferrell's name recently. That was really weird. The Anchorman. But, yeah, so, and then he was being mentored by her really fast in the sort of, in the Gom Jabbar. And I think once I got to that Gom Jabbar sequence and the whole, you know, fear is the mind killer stuff, that was really powerful. And right off the bat, that sequence was helping me, like myth should, to have a new insight on how to deal with fear. And that's when myths at its best, right? It's teaching you about how to deal with the world and your own internal ways of reacting to external things. That's what that scene is. You put your hand inside the Gom Jabbar. I just realized that. It's a metaphor for going inside yourself to deal with the external problems. That's mythology in a nutshell. So I was hooked right from the bat with that.
It really is. I think the first, at least the first three or four chapters is about Paul being tested, not only as physically tested with the sword fight, obviously with Gurney Halleck. He's tested also physically and mentally by both, obviously, the Reverend Mother, but also Thufa Hawat as well, with the Mentat.
So, yeah, Thufa, right, was another mentor, a Mentat. So He was teaching Paul in this sort of the mechanical, mathematical computation side of being a Mentat. So, right. So Paul was getting, trained to be basically superhuman by all these different people.
Yeah, you
mean... But within all that, it was what was automatically amazing was just Frank's way of writing is almost like watching Star Wars. It's so fun to read. He can deal with the highest concepts, yet still make the interpersonal dialogue and relationships and descriptions of scenes and locations so fun. It's fun right from the get-go.
It really is. I mean, the first novel, and each one of them has their own voice in that way too. That, like obviously right now I'm catching up with God Emperor of Dune, and that's more a textbook than it is a novel in some ways, because of its, I think some of the theories of life in there are just fantastic. But when you get down to Dune, yes, it is simply one of the greatest hero's journeys with a tapestry of rich plot, ideas, high concepts of science fiction in there and life. And I think the introduction to it is such a well laid out thing, because we obviously get the idea of these great schools. We also get the fact that there's, why are they sword fighting in the future? Well, we kind of get the idea because of shields, body shields. We find out of that in the fight.
And isn't that another, that must have influenced Lucas, that whole idea of like there's these kind of medieval things like sword fighting in the future, and that must have influenced Star Wars.
Oh, hugely. And you think about it, I mean, that's got to have, I mean, right through to, well, the idea that you can have sword and sorcery, epic battles with, modern weaponry and even futuristic fighter craft, and then sword fights as well. I mean, it's really a mix of those different areas. And we also get the introduction of the planets. So the first one being Caladan, which I think is probably the closest to Earth in some regards. It's a beautiful planet, rich with water, and obviously it's almost the complete mirror image of Arrakis, which we're going to find out.
What I like is, that I wouldn't say that Arrakis is an allegory for the Middle East. I wouldn't say that Caladan is allegory for Earth, because I think that's what makes Tolkien and Herbert, their writing strong, is that it feels like it's its own world, it's its own myth, they're real places, and they're not allegories for stuff. But of course they're influenced by it. And Tolkien used the word when he said, I hate allegory, like the ring is not allegory for nuclear power. He said, yet if fantasy and symbols are written well, they're applicable. You can apply things. The greater something is, you can apply something like the ring or Iraq East to the Middle East, the better the writing is, really. And I just realized that Iraqi sounds like Iraq.
Yeah, it kind of does. And I think one of the key things, too, about that is, it's related to any form of thing that gives you power. At the end of the day, obviously, the spice, which gets introduced very, very quickly in this book, is, could be easily pertaining to whether it's fuel, oil, whatever, or anything that is producing, something that's going to, make somebody wealthy or powerful. And that's, that's what you can take away from that part of it too. So in the first part, we are introduced to the world of Dune. We start on Caladan, where basically Paul has woken up. He's having visions already of a sand planet, of basically water somewhere on that planet as well, and that there's a lady there calling to him. So he's got these visions, and he's taken directly to the Reverend Mother, of course, Helen Gaius Mohim, who tests him with the box. So he's tested and finds out that basically he is human, or in this case, human, in the case of the Bene Gesserit, looking for the Kwisatz-Haderach, the prime super being.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the thing that happens where she says, we got to see if you're human, she finds out he's human. She said, you survived the test because you lasted in it. And she, her mentorship was, if this is a trap, a human would endure the suffering for that moment to come where they can exact their revenge on the person that set the trap. Mm-hmm. So I guess if you imagine you're a bear in a trap, you're going to wait for the human to come along to claw the... And that's such a... I love that. I think because I don't know really what's meant by that statement, like what the wisdom they're trying to impart there, because it seems like a statement of revenge, or maybe it's how to get out of the trap. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, as the story moves forward, you can see what Frank's done there. Basically, he's giving you basically a foreshadow of what's going to happen a little bit later, and that Paul already
I got
this,
that.
Paul already has the whole idea is to set up the fact that Paul didn't know that beforehand, and he then uses that once they're on Arrakis to realize that sometimes the only way to step through a trap is to see yourself through it and actually see that you have to bear the trap to actually go and seek revenge later, which he does. I mean, it's literally a bigger version of that same scene. It's a test.
I'm just confused as how he's saying, are you human because it's just a basic logical human reaction to want revenge? Because that seems to be, is he saying revenge is a natural human emotion, or is he actually promoting revenge? I think in the end, he's not, because he shows that Paul's revenge ends up having bad consequences for the galaxy. Which, you know what? That's very Star Wars. And then I just realized George Lucas was big on that with springing the trap. And he talks a lot about traps in Star Wars, too. Yes, everyone, I'm going to relate everything to Star Wars.
So as we move forward, they're given the fiefdom of Arrakis. Duke Leto and Jessica and also Paul arrive on Arrakis to a huge spectacle. And obviously the people of Arrakis now have them as their leaders. And they go to Arrakeen, and we start to see some of the players in this. We start to see, obviously, people like the Fremen. So Stilgar comes through with Duncan Idaho, the Swordmaster Gnaz there. And obviously the whole setting is basically about them trying to find out what the Harkonnen have done previous to this and to relate to the people, hey, look, we're here, we're not like the Harkonnen, we're actually going to help you. But with that comes the treachery of the Sardaukar, which are there in number somewhere. And this is one of the things that starts to get through, that we have a traitor in the midst. And much of the book is about who is the traitor and the fact that they all know somebody within the ranks is actually a traitor.
And I recently found out that Dune was first published in the weekly or monthly installments in what was Joseph Campbell's publication.
That's true.
So I didn't know that, and it makes sense because the hero's journey is so evident, you know, in this book. It's so classic hero's journey. And then what I also found out was that in the later two books, Joseph Campbell and Frank Herbert had a falling out, and Joseph Campbell didn't pay Frank Herbert to produce the installments in the next book in his magazine, because he disagreed where he took the hero's journey of Paul in book 2 and 3, where he became an anti-hero. Mm-hmm. So Herbert was trying to say, well, I followed the hero's journey, but then, if you live long enough, you see yourself become the villain. And so Herbert was just trying to be honest with himself of how he saw heroes happen in the world and what happened to their fate. It's very interesting. It kind of reminds me of Last Jedi, would Campbell not have liked The Last Jedi because it turns the hero into the anti-hero?
It could do. Cool. One of the interesting things about this, obviously, that everything gets turned on its head when we actually do finally see who is the traitor. So the shout-out mates, who's basically head of the household and is Fremen, is taken out by a traitor. Duke Leto actually rushes to her aid before she passes and then is hit by the same assailant. And it ends up being Dr. Wellington Yue, their Sook doctor, who is almost, one of the last people that I would think would be a traitor because of his imperial conditioning, which is set to be servant to any of those houses that he is brought to. But unfortunately, the Harkonnen have got to him through his wife, and through that betrayal, he has taken them out. So he paralyzes Duke, but he says, I'm going to let you have your revenge. You know, you were going to die anyway, but remember the tooth. The tooth. And he's given a poison gas tooth that when he's close to the Baron, he'll be able to kill him. And what ends up happening is everyone gets captured. And of course, we have Paul and Jessica captured by the Harkonnen themselves. And what ends up being a scene where they're basically getting out and away from the Harkonnen. They are able to get into the siege where Liet Kynes is. And Liet, along with Duncan, get them away to safety. But not at the same time, the Duke himself gets a chance at revenge. And when he thinks, well, he's got to remember, he's drugged up at this stage in chains. And he actually gets to try and kill the Baron with a poison gas tooth. Unfortunately, it's not the Baron. It's Peter De Vries, which was quite an interesting scene, particularly in the movie, where the Baron goes, I'm alive! You know, he really gets into it. But in the book, you get the same feel. You know, the Baron knows, hey, I got past that. That could have been me. And then we finally see, after an attack again by the Harkonnens, Jessica and Paul getting away in an ornithopter out into the deep desert, but they crash land. It's pretty much where we leave off into the next book.
The Doctor, who Yui,
yep,
he does genuinely love the Atreides family. Mm-hmm. It's just that the Harkonnens had his wife and basically said we can give you your wife back, like they could bring her back to life or something.
Yeah.
If you betray the Atreides for us, basically, if you kill Paul and Duke Leto, you know, Duke and his son Paul. Paul's the heir to the Atreides leadership. So, you know, basically, you kill them, and then we'll give you your wife back. So he sells his soul to the devil, which is the real devil. And as I said, is Baron Harkonnen, and he's represented by red, and House Harkonnen. Everything's red in design, but Yui, like you said, still wants to help the Atreides, so he allows Duke Leto this tooth that he can bite to release gas and kill Harkonnen when the Duke finally gets in Baron Harkonnen's presence. He also leaves this hopter, which is like the helicopter of Iraqis, for Jessica and Paul to escape on into the desert and hopefully find help from the Fremen. And even though they will likely die in this desert, at least there's a shot that they could survive. And then that's how the book ends there, right?
That's right. I have a deep feeling that Villeneuve will do the same.
What I really found cool about this whole first section is that it's long and slow, but still intriguing. And that is like the first third of Star Wars A New Hope as well. And the reason why I mention this and why it's really profound is that before we talk about the next two parts, what's tantamount to understanding them is that Frank Herbert, just as a writer, just chose to write the book, and there's a word for this, but where a story starts off really slow and every chapter exponentially speeds up. So he wrote it intentionally that the book speeds up with every chapter so that by the time you get to the end and the climax happens, you feel totally exhilarated. Almost like a car revving up faster and faster and faster. The climax is the finish line, you know? and he wanted people to feel exhilarated by the end. And it's interesting that really A New Hope does that too. It's movies just aren't made like that these days, and I wish they were. Like, things can't be slow anymore at the beginning, they have to be fast. But there's something to be said for this form of writing, which, like I said, does have a name, which starts off slow and then ends with exhilaration. So I guess when, as we move into the second part, that's when things start to speed up a bit, mid-tempo.
They certainly do. So folks, join us on the next one, where we also talk with Kyle about the 2000 miniseries on Sci-Fi Channel.
Well, Adam, it's been interesting. It's one of the more interesting conversations I've had in a while about a film. And, you know, when you came to me with the Dune project, I know you're kind of having a hard time finding people to jump into Dune, because it's one of those things where people's like, it's Dune. It's a heavy thing to talk about. And it's fun to talk about this film because it's so different and it's unique. I don't want to say it's a bad film. It's just, it's not what it should have been. And
yeah, that's right.
And for me, it's one of those things that there's such a wasted opportunity, but it has such a unique history to it and how this film came about that I think it's one of those films that I would tell a lot of people to see, just so you understand the history of where this film came from and where it does fall in science fiction, because it is Dune. I mean, it's not a translation of the books, and even in minor comparison, but it still is Dune, and there's a place for this movie in the history of fandom and history of sci-fi. And I think it's one of those things, it's an educational tool at this point to see what can happen when things don't go quite as planned, or you get in over your head with a entity. Well, I think that's kind of my feelings on Dune.
Mine too. Now, before we finish up, folks, we're going to look at our favorite scenes each. This is something we're going to be doing over the next three episodes. What is your favorite scene in this? So, Kyle, take us through one scene that for you that stands out to what it means to be Dune in the 1984 film.
It's the attack on House Harkonnen, and with riding in on the worms, everything that goes on in that battle. I think that's one of the things that Dune hit right, whether it was true to the book or not, was that climactic battle just felt really well done.
Definitely. Yeah, for me, it is going right back to the start of the adaptation, where we see Gurney Halleck giving our dear friend Paul Atreides a bit of a lesson when it comes to body shields and, of course, that amazing sword fight. He goes, if you had fought one whip without your ability, I'll give you a good scarty and I mind you. You know, he's almost a little bit of Scottish in there, the way that he's bringing it through. But it says everything about, here's a kid that's being about to thrown into the maelstrom. How do you face it? Do you face it for real, or do you face it with play? And that's really what that is about. And it's adapted very well from the actual book itself. So before we go, folks, we must say you have to check out the different shows that we have here on Fandom Podcast Network. Your choice for podcasting when it comes to great programming. With Culture Clash, the weekly fandom show, we have Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast, with, of course, your amazing friend, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel, and, of course, the amazing Norm C. Lau, who is, of course, a massive Dune fan too. We'll have to get him on here as well soon. We have Discoville podcast looking at Star Trek Discovery and the Orville. We also have Couch Potato Theater with...
This podcast feels a little familiar right now.
We also have, of course, Time Warp and Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, and The End Zone, which, of course, looks at American football, doesn't it?
Yes. He is the Raider nerd, and I have to give him his, you know, Raider comeuppance.
That's right. You don't dare mention the Denver Broncos.
No, never. But because I'm a Kansas City Chiefs fan, so that's just that the Denver Donkeys are off limits.
That's it. You know what's sad? I even have a Denver Broncos hat from when my parents were over there. They said, I think this is the Broncos. We'll give it a shot. I said, well, it's a little bit different from the Brisbane Broncos, which are our heroes out here.
Ah, yes. But, you know, we love our American football. But, you know, we all hear it all the time about you Australians and your rugby. And that's what real men do.
And we don't wear shoulder pads and helmets, mate.
Yeah. That's okay. I'll still take my body shield.